Turning the Tide. Robben Island, Cape Town Province, United States of Southern Africa. Zalawa Zanya greets me at his writing desk, inviting me to switch places with him so I can enjoy the cool ocean breeze from his window. He apologizes for the mess and insists on clearing the notes off his desk before we continue. Mr. Azanya is halfway through his third volume of Rainbow Fist, South Africa at War. This volume happens to be about the subject we are discussing, the turning point against the living dead, the moment when his country pulled itself back from the brink. Dispassionate. A rather mundane word to describe one of history's most controversial figures. Some revere him as a savior. Some revile him as a monster. But if you ever met Paul Redeker, ever discussed his views of the world and the problems, or more importantly, the solutions to the problems that plague the world, probably the one word that would always cling to your impression of the man is dispassionate. Paul always believed, well, perhaps not always, but at least in his adult life, that humanity's one fundamental flaw was emotion. He used to say that the heart should only exist to pump blood to the brain, that anything else was a waste of time and energy. His papers from university, all dealing with alternate solutions to historical, societal quandaries, were what first brought him to the attention of the apartheid government. Many psychobiographers have tried to label him a racist, but in his own words, racism is a regrettable byproduct of irrational emotion. Others have argued that in order for a racist to hate one group, he must at least love another. Redeker believed both love and hate to be irrelevant. To him, they were impediments of the human condition. And in his words again, imagine what could be accomplished if the human race would only shed its humanity. Evil? Most would call it that, while others, particularly that small cadre in the center of Praetoria's power, believed it to be an invaluable source of liberated intellect. It was the early 1980s, a critical time for the apartheid government. The country was resting on a bed of nails. You had the ANC, you had the Inkatha Freedom Party, you even had extremist right-wing elements of the Afrikaner population that would have liked nothing better than open revolt in order to bring about a complete racial showdown. On her border, South Africa faced nothing but hostile nations, and in the case of Angola, a Soviet-backed, Cuban-spearheaded civil war. Add to this mixture a growing isolation from the Western democracies, which included a critical arms embargo, and it was no surprise that a last-ditch fight for survival was never far from Pretoria's mind. This is why they enlisted the aid of Mr. Redeker to revise the government's ultra-secret Plan Orange. Orange had been in existence since the apartheid government first came to power in 1948. It was the doomsday scenario for the country's white minority, the plan to deal with an all-out uprising of its indigenous African population. Over the years, it had been updated with the changing strategic outlook of the region. Every decade, that situation grew more and more grim, with multiplying independence of her neighbor states and multiplying voices for freedom from the majority of her own people. Those in Pretoria realized that a full-blown confrontation might not just mean the end for the Afrikaner government, but the Afrikaners themselves. This is where Redeker stepped in. His revised Plan Orange, appropriately completed in 1984, was the ultimate survival strategy for the Afrikaner people. No variable was ignored: population figures, terrain, resources, logistics. Redeker not only updated the plan to include both Cuba's chemical weapons and his own country's nuclear option, but also, and this is what made Orange 84 so historic, The determination of which Afrikaners would be saved and which had to be sacrificed.
Sacrificed?
Redeker believed that to try to protect everyone would stretch the government's resources to the breaking point, thus dooming the entire population. He compared it to survivors from a sinking ship capsizing a lifeboat that simply did not have room for them all. Redeker had even gone so far as to calculate who should be brought aboard. He included income, IQ, fertility, an entire checklist of desirable qualities, including the subject's location to a potential crisis zone. "The first casualty of the conflict must be our own sentimentality," was the closing statement for his proposal, "for its survival will mean our destruction." Orange 84 was a brilliant plan. It was clear, logical, efficient, and it made Paul Redeker one of the most hated men in South Africa. His first enemies were some of the more radical fundamentalist Afrikaners, the racial ideologues and the ultra-religious. Later, after the fall of apartheid, his name began circulating among the general population. Of course, he was invited to appear before the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, and of course he refused. "I won't pretend to have a heart simply to save my skin," he stated publicly, adding, "No matter what I do, I'm sure they will come for me anyway." And they did, although it probably was not in the manner Redeker could have expected. It was during our great panic, which began several weeks before yours. Redeker was holed up in the Drakensberg cabin he had bought with the accumulated profits of a business consultant. He liked business, you know. "One goal, no soul," he used to say. He wasn't surprised when the door blew off its hinges and agents of the National Intelligence Agency rushed in. They confirmed his name, his identity, his past actions. They asked him point blank if he had been the author of Orange 84. He answered without emotion, naturally. He suspected and accepted this intrusion as a last-minute revenge killing. The world was going to hell anyway. Why not take a few apartheid devils down first? What he could have never predicted was the sudden lowering of their firearms and the removal of the gas masks of the NIA agents. They were of all colors, black, Asian, colored, and even a white man, a tall Afrikaner who stepped forward and, without giving his name or rank, asked abruptly, "You've got a plan for this, man, don't you?" Redeker had indeed been working on his own solution to the undead epidemic. What else could he do in this isolated hideaway? It had been an intellectual exercise. He never believed anyone would be left to read it. It had no name, as explained later, because names only exist to distinguish one from others, and until that moment there had been no other plan like his. Once again, Redeker had taken everything into account, not only the strategic situation of the country, but also the physiology, behavior, and combat doctrine of the living dead. While you can research the details of the Redeker plan in any public library around the world, here are some of the fundamental keys. First of all, there was no way to save everyone. The outbreak was too far gone. The armed forces had already been too badly weakened to effectively isolate the threat, and spread so thinly throughout the country they could only grow weaker with each passing day. Our forces had to be consolidated, withdrawn to a special safe zone, which hopefully would be aided by some natural obstacle, such as mountains, rivers, or even an offshore island. Once concentrated within this zone, the armed forces could eradicate the infestation within its borders, then use what resources were available to defend it against further onslaughts of the living dead. That was the first part of the plan, and it made as much sense as any conventional military retreat. The second part of the plan dealt with the evacuation of civilians, and this could not have been envisioned by anyone else but Redeker. In his mind, only a small fraction of the civilian population could be evacuated to the safe zone. These people would be saved not only to provide a labor pool for the eventual wartime economic restoration, but also to preserve the legitimacy and stability of the government, to prove to those already within the zone that their leaders were looking out for them. There was another reason for this partial evacuation, an eminently logical and insidiously dark reason that many believe will forever ensure Rediker the tallest pedestal in the pantheon of hell. Those who were left behind were to be herded into special isolated zones. They were to be human bait, distracting the undead from following the retreating army to their safe zone. Rediker argued that these isolated, uninfected refugees must be kept alive, well defended, and even resupplied if possible, so as to keep the undead hordes firmly rooted to the spot. You see the genius, the sickness, keeping people as prisoners because every zombie besieging those survivors will be one less zombie throwing itself against our defenses. That was the moment when the Afrikaner agent looked up at Rediker, crossed himself, and said, "God help you, man." Another one said, "God help us all." That was the black one who appeared to be in charge of the operation. "Now let's get him out of here." Within minutes, they were on a helicopter for Kimberley, the very underground base where Rediker had first written Orange 84. He was ushered into a meeting of the president's surviving cabinet, where his report was read aloud to the room. You should have heard the uproar, with no voice louder than the defense minister's. He was a Zulu, a ferocious man who'd rather be fighting in the streets than cowering in a bunker. The vice president was more concerned about public relations. He didn't want to imagine what his backside would be worth if news of this plan ever leaked to the population. The president looked almost personally insulted by Rediker. He physically grabbed the lapels of the safety and security minister and demanded why in hell he brought him this demented apartheid war criminal. The minister stammered that he didn't understand why the president was so upset, especially when it was he who gave the order to find Rediker. The president threw his hands in the air and shouted that he never gave such an order, and then from somewhere in the room a faint voice said, "I did." He had been sitting against the back wall. Now he stood, hunched over by age and supported by canes, but with a spirit as strong and vital as it had ever been. The elder statesman, the father of our new democracy, the man whose birth name had been Ralilala, which some have translated simply into troublemaker. As he stood, all others sat, all others except Paul Rediker. The old man locked eyes on him, smiled with that warm squint so famous the world over, and said, "Molo mloboam. Greetings, person of my region." He walked slowly over to Paul, turned to the governing body of South Africa, then lifted the pages from the Afrikaner's hand, and said in a suddenly loud and youthful voice, "This plan will save our people." Then, gesturing to Paul, he said, "This man will save our people." And then came that moment, the one that historians will probably debate until the subject fades from memory. He embraced the white Afrikaner. To anyone else, this was simply his signature bear hug, but to Paul Rediker. I know that the majority of psychobiographers continue to paint this man without a soul. That is the generally accepted notion. Paul Rediker. No feelings, no compassion, no heart. However, one of our most revered authors, Biko's old friend and biographer, postulates that Rediker was actually a deeply sensitive man. Too sensitive, in fact, for life in apartheid South Africa. He insists that Rediker's lifelong jihad against emotion was the only way to protect his sanity from the hatred and brutality he witnessed on a daily basis. Not much is known about Rediker's childhood, whether he even had parents or was raised by the state, whether he had friends or was ever loved in any way. Those who knew him from work were hard-pressed to remember witnessing any social interaction or even any physical act of warmth. The embrace by our nation's father, this genuine emotion piercing his impenetrable shell. Azania smiles sheepishly. Perhaps this is all too sentimental. For all we know, he was a heartless monster, and the old man's embrace had absolutely no impact. But I can tell you that that was the last day anyone ever saw Paul Redeker. Even now, no one knows what really happened to him. That is when I stepped in. In those chaotic weeks when the Redeker plan was implemented throughout the country, it took some convincing, to say the least, but once I'd convinced them that I'd worked for many years with Paul Redeker, and more importantly, I understood his way of thinking better than anyone left alive in South Africa, how could they refuse? I worked on the retreat, then afterward, during the consolidation months, and right up until the end of the war. At least they were appreciative of my services. Why else would they grant me such luxurious accommodations? Smiles. Paul Redeker, an angel and a devil. Some hate him, some worship him. Me, I just pity him. If he still exists, somewhere out there, I sincerely hope he's found his peace. After a parting embrace from my guest, I am driven back to my ferry for the mainland. Security is tight as I sign out my entrance badge. The tall Afrikaner guard photographs me again. "Can't be too careful, man," he says, handing me the pen. "Lot of people out there want to send him to hell." I sign next to my name, under the heading of Robben Island Psychiatric Institution. "Name of patient you are visiting." Paul Redeker.